Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 248, entitled Bushed, the Political Heritage of George W. Of course, George W. Bush is running on the Republican ticket for President of the United States, as I'm recording this on September 4th of the year 2000. George W., I guess one could say, is the heir to a political tradition, and we're going to get right into that political tradition right now, and we're going to dip into the other For the Record segments that have been recorded over the years and begin to access some of the information contained therein. The first segment that we're going to listen to comes from For the Record program number 186, and that in turn is entitled, What Does the W in George W. Bush Stand For? The material is taken from a book called The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by former military officer and Justice Department investigator John Loftus and his co-author Mark Ahrens. These two gentlemen have drawn on a number of former intelligence operatives, both British and American, termed the old spies. John Loftus had power of attorney for those, and in turn was able to get printing rights from the Central Intelligence Agency on condition of anonymity. In turn, this book, approximately 500 pages or so in terms of text, contains about 115 pages of footnotes. The title is unfortunate because I think people who dislike Jews will not read it. Also, it sounds like some sort of mega conspiracy theory. It really deals with the interrelationship between the petroleum industry and the intelligence community and international fascism. Once again, this is from For the Record program number 186. In turn, this is from The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. Hard and soft cover editions, copyright St. Martin's Press, 1994. Writing of George Herbert Walker, the man for whom our former president was named and for whom the W in George W stands for, we read as follows. Walker was one of Hitler's most powerful financial supporters in the United States. The relationship went all the way back to 1924 when Fritz Thyssen, the German industrialist, was financing Hitler's infant Nazi party. As mentioned in earlier chapters, there were American contributors as well. Some Americans were just bigots and made their connections to Germany through Alan Dulles' firm of Sullivan and Cromwell because they supported fascism. The Dulles brothers, who were in it for profit more than ideology, arranged American investments in Nazi Germany in the 1930s to ensure that their clients did well out of the German economic recovery. Quote, Dulles clearly emphasized projects for Germany and for Mussolini's fascist state. All told, these and more than a dozen similar transactions had a combined value in excess of $1 billion. Sullivan and Cromwell was not the only firm engaged in funding Germany. According to the Splendid Blonde Beast, Christopher Simpson's seminal history of the politics of genocide and profit, Brown Brothers Harriman was another bank that specialized in investments in Germany. The key figure in the firm was Averell Harriman, a dominating figure in the American establishment who, for almost half a century, helped form many of Washington's major foreign policies. Some of his allies in this latter endeavor, who also served on the firm's board, included Robert Levette, who, as previously discussed, worked closely with James Forrestal to lead the State Department's revolt against Truman's pro-Zionist policy during the UN debate on the partition of Palestine, and George Bush's father, Prescott, who later became a U.S. senator. The firm originally was known as W.A. Harriman & Company. The link between Harriman & Company's American investors and Thyssen started in the 1920s through the Union Banking Corporation, which began trading in 1924. The Harriman Company and the Union Banking Corporation, two of the links between the Wall Street crowd and Fritz Thyssen, and just who the key people were in the Union Banking Corporation and Harriman, discussed here as follows by Loftus and Ahrens. In just 1 3-year period, the Harriman firm sold more than $50 million of German bonds to American investors. Bert Walker was Union Banking's president, and the firm was located in the offices of Averell Harriman's company at 39 Broadway in New York. In 1926, Bert Walker did a favor for his new son-in-law, Prescott Bush. It was the sort of favor families do to help their children make a start in life, but Prescott came to regret it bitterly. Walker made Prescott vice president of W.A. Harriman. The problem was that Walker's specialty was companies that traded with Germany. As Fritz Thyssen and the other German industrialists consolidated Hitler's political power in the 1930s, an American financial connection was needed. According to our sources, union banking became an out-and-out Nazi money laundering machine. As we shall see, there is substantial evidence to support this charge. Note that Harriman Company and union banking with Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush, George W.'s grandfather and the father of the president and former CIA director, being centrally involved in union banking and Harriman and Company, that placed them right in the middle of the financing of the fascist powers of Europe, Hitler in particular, and also placed them in direct contact with the Thyssens. Bear in mind that the genesis of that relationship took place at the same time as the genesis of the relationship between Martin Bormann and the Thyssens. More on Prescott Bush and Herbert Walker's financing of Nazi Germany. While the United States languished in the Depression, Walker made millions for his clients by investing in Germany's economic revival. He decided to quit W.A. Harriman in 1931 to concentrate on his own firm, G.H. Walker, while his son-in-law stayed behind to run the show for Harriman. Some say that Walker left George Bush's father holding the bag. Others say that Bush specialized in British investors in Nazi Germany, while Walker handled the Americans. In that same year, Harriman and Company merged with a British-American investment company to become Brown Brothers Harriman. Prescott Bush became one of the senior partners of the new company, which relocated to 59 Broadway, while Union Banking remained at 39 Broadway. But in 1934, Walker arranged to put his son-in-law on the board of directors of Union Banking. Now, the next passage here discusses the Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush's relationship to the Hamburg America line, which was not only a cover for Nazi industrial espionage and regular espionage in the United States, but as we shall see, the Hamburg America line was one of the companies that figured significantly in the Bormann Flight Capital Organization's machinations. The relationship between the Bush family and the Hamburg America line and the Bormann group for the Hamburg America line, yet another element suggestive of the distinct possibility that the Bush family may be linked to, and in fact, as I am of the opinion, a front for the Bormann group in the United States. Continuing. Walker also set up a deal to take over the North American operations of the Hamburg America line, a cover for I.G. Farben's Nazi espionage unit in the United States. The shipping line smuggled in German agents, propaganda, and money for bribing American politicians to see things Hitler's way. The holding company was Walker's American Shipping and Commerce, which shared the offices at 39 Broadway with Union Banking. In an elaborate corporate paper trail, Harriman's stock in American Shipping and Commerce was controlled by yet another holding company, the Harriman 15 Corporation, run out of Herbert Walker's office. The directors of this company were Averell Harriman, Bert Walker, and Prescott Bush, two of the three directors of the parent company of the Hamburg America line, a key element of the Bormann group and a major vehicle for Nazi espionage in the United States. Bert Walker and Prescott Bush, George W.'s great-grandfather and grandfather, respectively. Continuing. In order to understand the character of this firm, it should be recalled that Brown Brothers Harriman had a bad reputation, even among international bankers, as hard-nosed capitalists who exploited every opportunity for profit in a harsh and ruthless manner. In a November 1935 article in Common Sense, retired Marine General Smedley D. Butler blamed Brown Brothers Harriman for having the U.S. Marines act like, quote, racketeers, unquote, and, quote, gangsters, unquote, in order to exploit financially the peasants of Nicaragua. At some point, Prescott Bush must have realized that his father-in-law was, to put it mildly, a very shady character. A 1934 congressional investigation alleged that Walker's Hamburg America line, quote, Hamburg America line subsidized a wide range of pro-Nazi propaganda efforts both in Germany and the United States, unquote. And again, note that Hamburg America will be a key element of the Bormann group. Skipping down, instead of divesting the Nazi money, Prescott Bush hired a lawyer to hide the assets. The lawyer he hired had considerable expertise in such underhanded schemes. It was Alan Dulles. According to Dulles' client list at Sullivan and Cromwell, his first relationship with Brown Brothers Harriman was on June 18, 1936. In January of 1937, Dulles listed his work for the firm as, quote, disposal of Standard Oil investing stock, unquote. As discussed in Chapter 3, Standard Oil of New Jersey had completed a major stock transaction with Dulles' Nazi client, I.G. Farben. By the end of January of 1937, Dulles had merged all his cloaking activities into one client account, quote, Brown Brothers, Harriman, Schroeder, and Rockefeller. Schroeder, of course, was the Nazi bank on whose board Dulles sat. The Rock were the Rockefellers of Standard Oil, who were already coming under scrutiny for their Nazi deals. By May 1939, Dulles handled another problem for Brown Brothers Harriman, their securities custodian accounts, unquote. If Dulles was trying to conceal how many Nazi holding companies Brown Brothers Harriman was connected with, he did not do a very good job. Shortly after Pearl Harbor, word leaked from Washington that affiliates of Prescott Bush's company were under investigation for aiding the Nazis in time of war. In February of 1942, George Bush's father, who was by then the senior managing partner of Brown Brothers Harriman, tried to wrap himself in the American flag, and skipping down, he did so unsuccessfully, as we shall see. Under the Trading with the Enemy Act, all the shares of the Union Banking Corporation were seized, including those held by Prescott Bush as being, in effect, held for enemy nationals. Union Banking, of course, was an affiliate of Brown Brothers Harriman, and Bush handled the Harriman's investments as well. Once the government had its hands on Bush's books, the whole story of the intricate web of Nazi front corporations began to unravel. A few days later, two of Union Banking's subsidiaries, the Holland American Trading Corporation and the Seamless Steel Equipment Corporation, also were seized. Then, the government went after the Harriman 15 Holding Company, which Bush shared with his father-in-law, Bert Walker, the Hamburg America Line, and the Silesian American Corporation. The U.S. government found that huge sections of Prescott Bush's empire had been operated on behalf of Nazi Germany and had greatly assisted the German war effort. And that is from For the Record Program 186. Also from For the Record Program number 186 was part of the heritage stretching from Prescott Bush Sr., George W.'s grandfather, to Richard Nixon, to George Herbert Walker Bush, W.'s father. We're going to take a look at the role of George Herbert Walker Bush in incorporating the Nazi intelligence, Nazi emigre outfit that we've looked at in a number of different broadcasts, including For the Record Programs 29, 48, and 113 into the Republican Party as a permanent part of the Republican Party. This took place when George Bush was chairman of the Republican National Committee. He was appointed as head of the RNC by Richard Nixon and supervised Richard Nixon's stepping down as not only head of the Republican Party, but as president, or at least oversaw it as sort of a political shepherd. This also comes from The Secret War Against the Jews, and also comes from For the Record Program number 186. What we're going to look at now is George Bush's post-World War II involvement with the Nazi emigre milieu that we've looked at in the past. This milieu was heavily overlapped with the Reinhard Gehlen Eastern Front Nazi spy outfit that jumped to the CIA, and also with organizations like the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, basically a renaming of Hitler's Committee of Subjugated Nations from 1943, a consortium of Central and Eastern European fascist groups allied with Nazi Germany. These same Nazi emigres, or fascist freedom fighters, as John Loftus and Mark Ahrens termed them, were involved in the Crusade for Freedom, in which many of these people, war criminals, some of them of the First Order, were brought into the United States to serve as leaders in our Eastern European ethnic communities. This project was the godchild of Alan Dulles, who helped to mask the Nazi assets. It was run for Dulles by Richard Nixon. The chief spokesperson for this project was Ronald Reagan, and the person who handled the State Department machinations to bring them into the United States was William Casey, who then, of course, became Reagan's campaign manager later on and Reagan's CIA director. That, by the way, is discussed in For the Record segments 29 and also For the Record 48. Turning once again to the secret war against the Jews, we're now going to take a look at George Bush's role in helping to bring these Nazi emigres into the Republican Party in a formal way. They coalesced as the Republican Ethnic Heritage Organization and became a formal and very important element of the Republican Party, literally a Nazi wing of the Republican Party with its roots firmly planted in the Third Reich. Note also the closeness between the Bush family and the Nixons. Prescott Bush, George W.'s grandfather, was very close to Nixon and reputedly recruited Nixon to be vice president under Eisenhower, and George Bush in his biography describes Richard Nixon as his mentor. Of the relationship between George Bush and Richard Nixon and George Bush's shepherding of this Nazi milieu into its formal inclusion as a permanent part of the Republican Party, we read as follows in The Secret War Against the Jews. The most intriguing of Bush's early connections was to Richard Nixon, who as vice president had supervised Allen Dulles' covert planning for the Bay of Pigs. For years it had been rumored that Dulles' client, George Bush's father, was one of the Republican leaders who recruited Nixon to run for Congress and later convinced Eisenhower to take him on as vice president. There is no doubt that the two families were close. George Bush described Nixon as his mentor, unquote. Nixon was a Bush supporter in his very first tilt at politics during his unsuccessful run for the Senate in 1964 and turned out again when he entered the House 2 years later, skipping down. So in 1972, Richard Nixon appointed George Bush as head of the Republican National Committee. It was George Bush who fulfilled Nixon's promise to make the ethnic emigre a permanent part of Republican politics. In 1972, Nixon's State Department spokesman confirmed to his Australian counterpart that the ethnic groups were very useful to get out the vote in several key states. Bush's tenure as head of the Republican National Committee exactly coincided with Laszlo Pastor's 1972 drive to transform the Heritage Groups Council into the party's official ethnic arm. Laszlo Pastor, a Hungarian fascist and a member of the Arrow Cross organization, allied with Hitler. More about this formal coalescing of this Nazi milieu into a key wing of the Republican Party. The groups Pastor chose as Bush's campaign allies were the emigre fascists whom Dulles had brought to the United States. It seems clear that George Bush, as head of the Republican National Committee in 1972, must have known who these, quote, ethnics, unquote, really were. Columns by Jack Anderson and others had already made it clear in 1971 that Nixon was a little too close to the fascist groups. The Nazis for Nixon problem was one of those scandals that Bush inherited when he took over the Republican National Committee. And skipping down. When taken in conjunction with the earlier Australian report and the Washington Post revelation that Nazis were being used for U.S. campaign purposes, the Republican memo confirming Bush's, quote, full knowledge, unquote, of the ethnic campaign looks like a smoking gun as far as Bush's personal complicity is concerned. Nearly 20 years later, and after exposés in several respectable newspapers, George Bush continued to recruit most of the same ethnic fascists, including Laszlo Pastor, for his own 1988 ethnic outreach program when he first ran for president. According to a number of our sources in the intelligence community, it was Bush who told Nixon that the Watergate investigations might start uncovering the fascist skeletons in the Republican Party's closet. Bush himself acknowledges that he wrote Nixon a letter asking him to step down. The day after Bush did so, Nixon resigned. That again from For the Record program number 186. Dealing with yet another piece of text from The Secret War Against the Jews by Loftus and Ahrens. Again, a little under 500 pages worth of text and some 115 pages worth of footnotes in addition to the first-hand information from the old spies. We're going to turn now to part of George Bush's tenure as director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He was only CIA director for one full year, but an indication of his importance to the CIA was contained in an article that was carried in the San Francisco Examiner of yesterday, that being Sunday, Sunday, September 3rd of the year 2000. This is a Chicago Tribune story by Rick Pearson entitled CIA Briefs Bush on National Security. Speaking of George W., the article reads as follows, skipping down. Bush's father, former President George Bush, was chief of the CIA from January 1976 to January of 1977. In April of last year, Congress renamed the CIA's headquarters in Langley, Virginia, the George Bush Center for Intelligence. George Bush's importance to the intelligence community is indicated by the fact that he was only officially head of the CIA for 1 year. But it was a very eventful year indeed, and when George Bush was running for vice president in 1980, oil prices shot up, and that helped to destabilize Jimmy Carter. And George Bush was head of the CIA when a CIA report influenced by the petroleum industry helped to shape the rationalization on the part of the public and the acceptance for higher oil prices. This apparently was accomplished in cooperation with the Saudis as well as the petroleum industry. The George Bush CIA Saudi Arabian petroleum industry collaboration described by Loftus and Ahrens as follows. This, by the way, from For the Record program number 214, entitled Trouble on Oiled Waters, Part 2. And remember that when a George Bush was running for vice president in 1980, oil prices shot up. We now have George W. running for president in the year 2000. Look what's happening to oil prices. Even before Americans voted for Carter, the oil industry had launched a quiet crusade of its own in anticipation of a Democratic victory. In the last months of the Ford administration, the CIA had developed a series of papers on energy and oil issues. Just after his victory in November of 1976, Carter was shown a classified CIA analysis of global oil supplies. The old spies, unquote, we asked about this point, insist that the report had a powerful impact on Carter and helped to define his policies on the, quote, energy crisis, unquote. When Carter launched his National Energy Plan in April of 1977, he confirmed that the CIA had provided him with intelligence assessments which made dire predictions about future energy supplies in the Soviet Union. The CIA warning made front page news. Quote, Russia would be importing oil from the Middle East by 1985, unquote. The Soviets would need to buy 3.5 million barrels per day, to be precise, whereas in 1977, they actually exported 1.5 million barrels daily. Quote, previously, the assumption had been that the Soviets would continue to be self-sufficient in meeting their oil and gas needs, unquote. In order to bolster his energy crusade, unquote, the president was using the CIA to whip up a public frenzy about a looming conflict in the Middle East between the Soviet Union and the United States. The Associated Press ominously reported that, quote, in a few years, the USSR will face an energy crisis that is likely to sharpen U.S.-Soviet rivalries in the Middle East, CIA analysts predict. In effect, the CIA was telling President Carter that the Soviet Union would face a domestic oil shortage in 1985, causing the worst energy crisis in American history. When the Soviets ran out of domestic oil supplies, they probably would look to the traditional oil suppliers of the United States, especially Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. Our sources in the intelligence community say that the CIA's oil shortfall, unquote, probably was the greatest intelligence fraud in American history. James Jesus Angleton would have been envious. His vessel fraud had hidden one tiny corner of Allen Dulles' covert operations, but in the long run, the forgeries he passed to Presidents Roosevelt and Truman only had limited foreign policy effects. This refers to Angleton's forgery of some communications allegedly intercepted from the Vatican. Continuing, that's the reference to the vessel fraud. Continuing here. The oil fraud of the 1970s succeeded in getting the U.S. president to change his policy toward Israel and the Arabs completely and directly promoted the massive defense expenditures of the 1980s, all based on the false premise that the Soviets needed oil and were planning to invade the Middle East. Some of the former intelligence officers we spoke to were adamant that the CIA was not to blame. They claim that CIA contacts in the oil industry cooked the books on the Soviet shortage by feeding misleading data to the CIA. Quote, the agency had grown fat and lazy in the Middle East, explained one of our sources. Again quoting, the oil companies were a big retirement area for ex-CIA staff. There were so many ex-CIA working for the oil companies that it was easy to fake the data, unquote. Of course, ex-CIA is a term that should be taken with a generous dose of salt. Note also here that Jimmy Carter made a bargain with the devil, although he believed the CIA assessment and was sincerely deceived. Ultimately, his conservation policies were sabotaged, and Jimmy Carter himself was destabilized by, among other things, the inflation that helped to push him out of office and Ronald Reagan and George Bush in. Note that as we continue. Others in the intelligence community say that it was not the underlying data that were bad as much as the analysis that was skewed back at headquarters. Quote, "You have to understand who was screwing the Jews," unquote, one old spy told us. By the way, this refers to the petroleum industry's longstanding anti-Israel policy underlying the official pro-U.S. policy of the United States. Continuing. Underlying and in contrast with, I should say. Continuing. Quote, "The whole phony scheme, the oil shortages, the predictions about Soviet troops in the Middle East, the Saudi arms buildup, all of that crap started coming out of the agency back in 76. The CIA told their boss what he wanted to hear, and in those days, the head of the CIA was an oil man." That, of course, was George Bush. Continuing, "Perhaps the truth was somewhere in between. The CIA field agents slanted the data a bit to suit the oil industry, and the analysts exaggerated a bit more, According to several of our sources, the scheme to manufacture phony CIA estimates and push them on Carter began in the last days of Gerald Ford's term. They claim that a cabal within the CIA realized that Carter would be the new president, produced the first phony report, and then promptly gave it to Carter as soon as he won, knowing how it would affect his view of the energy crisis. It should be recalled that George Bush was the director of the CIA at the time the oil scam was put in place in 1976. There is some evidence to suggest that it was Bush himself who passed the fake oil estimates to Carter." And that, again, from For the Record program number 214, bear in mind that the chain of events set in motion by those phony oil reports ultimately led to the, well, one could not say the bankrupting of the United States, but the tripling of the national debt in 8 years. And it then went over $4 trillion under George Bush. The petroleum industry and the administration Bushes are inextricably linked, as we can see. We've seen it in For the Record program number 244. This article from the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, August 28th of the year 2000, a Chicago Tribune story by Bob Kemper, underscores that as well. It's entitled "Cheney, Bush Wrong About the Military," and it deals with Condoleezza Rice, who figures to become Bush's Secretary of State. She is his chief foreign policy advisor. And skipping down, we read, "Condoleezza Rice on Sunday defended the oil industry and its multiple ties to the Republican ticket. In addition to Bush and Cheney, Rice has ties of her own to the industry. She is a director of Chevron, which recently named one of its oil tankers after her." That concludes Side A of For the Record program number 248, Bushed, the heritage, political heritage of George W. This is being recorded on September 4th of the year 2000. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.